I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I am excited to have a whole host of people. I think this might be the most people I've had on the podcast, three different voices besides my own. So I'm excited to launch in because we're going to talk about soul force. And you might be wondering, what is soul force? Well, we're going to find that out in just a couple of moments. Mike, my husband, is with me. And then I have the authors of Soul Force with me as well, Rashida Graham Washington and Sean Castleberry. And we'll hear from them in just a minute. I wanted to take a quick moment to read just a couple of lines from a couple of emails that I got recently. Just to remind you, the email address for Faith Conversations is producer@anitalustria.com. And you guys have been representing. April said, thoughtful conversation. Really appreciate it. She listened to the podcast where we discussed the listener email, and she felt that it was kind of a shaming and presumptuous email. Appreciated the humility and willingness to engage with this listener's thoughts. And then she went on to talk about Melinda and I and said, you're fully adult wise women. Thanks for that. Mike might disagree from time to time, but I hope that's true.
Just periodically, yes.
Yeah, there you go. But you know, she just appreciated that we were becoming more comfortable with the discomfort of others and moving forward on new paths. And so, April, thank you for that. I didn't have time to read the whole email here. Cheryl said, I asked the question, would you keep listening if I had a story on of someone coming out, Vicki Beeching specifically in her book Undivided. Cheryl said, I'd love to hear her story. I support your decision to help us all understand the hurts and pain associated with growing up, knowing you're different, and the fear of rejection that is so often realized once a person comes out in the church. And she goes on to say, I have a son in a same-sex marriage, and I have regrets about how his adolescent years must have been for him, and I wish I could go back with what I know now and do it all over with more grace and love. And she talked about her own faith transition journey from conservative religiosity, which has been extremely painful, but also quite exhilarating. And she said, I've discovered the progressive Christian voices and love having my mind challenged and stretched. And she goes on to say some more things, but I thought that gives you the essence of Cheryl's thoughts. So those are just a couple. I've got a stack here, but I'll save some for other podcasts. So thank you so much. And I would love to hear from you. Any comments or thoughts on any podcast that you listen to or any questions that are raised, shoot us an email here, producer@anitalustria.com. That's also the same way that you can give on PayPal. That's the email address to use if you want to support and donate to the podcast. All right, moving on. Can you tell I'm talking fast because I want to get to our guests today? Rashida Graham Washington is the executive director of Communities First Association. It's a faith-based nonprofit committed to asset-based community development. And she coaches leaders in building community and developing sustainable and equitable practices within their organizations. I could go on. Well, I am going to go on a little bit here. Graham Washington tapped into Soul Force to launch. And I want to know, is this Live Cafe? Live Cafe. I want to get the right word.
Live Cafe.
Love it. Okay. An experimental community space that serves artisanal coffee and brings people together from across Chicago for conversation and mutual transformation. Sean Castleberry is executive director of Mission Year, a year-long urban ministry program that empowers young people to live a lifestyle of love and justice. He taps into Soul Force as a neighborhood advocate, youth mentor, prison volunteer, and justice activist. And I'll leave those intros there. There's so much more to these folks that we're talking with today. And then, as I mentioned already, Mike Murphy, my husband, is on the podcast with me. And what is there to say to introduce him?
I'm almost indescribable. So
exactly. Say no more. So grateful to have all of you here. And really, I have Mike as part of the conversation because for a number of years in his ministry life, he was a pastor. He's been a lot of different things, but he worked as the director of spiritual transformation at Breakthrough Urban Ministries on the west side of Chicago. And so certainly I feel like he would bring something and will bring something to this conversation today. So, Rashida, I'm going to start with you. I think before we get into, you know, deeper parts of this conversation today, we have to know what soul force is. That's the title of the book. I love that term. And certainly as I've been reading in the book, I love the description. But why don't you go ahead and tell folks what that is?
First of all, Anita, thank you so much for having us on Faith Conversations. It's an honor to be here for Sean and I, and just want to talk a little bit about what soul force is. So soul force is a term that was used, it's a Kingian term and a Gandhian term that is rooted in the Hindi word satyagraha. And what it means essentially is that we balance the truth of who we are and the love of who we are with the energy that resides within us to carry out who we are, our full identity, our authenticity, and our call and our purpose. So soul force is an energy, if you will, and a nonviolent energy that resides within each one of us that gives us the capacity to do and be all of whom God ever imagined us as doing and being. What is amazing about soul force is that it anticipates that everything that we need in order to carry out our full identity already lives inside of us and within our communities, and that we just have to tap into this force that is within us individually and also collectively and communally in order to be able to carry out the best of who we are. And so that's the essence of soul force. And it's important to note that as Sean and I write about soul force, we don't write about it as resident experts on it. Rather, we write about the vulnerability that is required from us to talk about it and the ways in which we have had to courageously tap into our own soul force in order to do the work that we do both at Live Community First Association and Mission Year as well. So the book really goes on to tie in the stories of other people that we've just had the honor of witnessing carry out their soul force as well. But it is accessible and available to all of us. And King and Gandhi, and we would say also Jesus, knew and understood soul force quite well. But what we also want to make clear is that soul force is available to the everyday peacemaker. It's available to the everyday activist. It's available to the everyday minister and missionary. So this is not something that's just accessible to martyrs, but to everyday people like ourselves. And we have the capacity to transform the world using what we have in our hearts and at our fingertips together.
Mm-hmm. I loved that. That soul force is available to everyday peacemakers, everyday activists, everyday ministers, missionaries. This is not reserved for martyrs or saints that have gone on before. This is available to us today. And let me turn over to Sean and see if you want to expand or add anything to what Rashida has already so beautifully said.
Well, she said it well. It's hard to add to that, but I will say we kind of came to this understanding of soul force in South Africa when we were together and we were on a pilgrimage with other faith leaders, and we wanted to engage some community folks in South Africa around some common struggles and issues that we were facing. But we were tired and we were kind of overwhelmed and feeling honestly a little hopeless about the state of things in the world, and we needed something. And this was not just an intellectual thing. This isn't just a book we're writing about, but this is something deep at our core. We needed something to keep going, to sustain ourselves in the work that we do. And we went to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was held many, many years. And just kind of retraced his steps and went to the cell where he had spent
like 18 years.
And just learned about how he came out with love and not bitterness and resentment. And we're just like, how do you do that? Like, how can we develop that kind of faith? And that really is the kind of faith that we want, that we feel like that is Christian faith. That is the love and the hope that Christ calls us to. And so it actually causes us to ask a lot of questions. So where does courage like that come from? And then we started looking at scriptures and saying, you know what? As you look through the Bible, faith looks a lot more like courage than anything else. Like you look at David and Goliath, like that faith took on the form of courageous action and living out what you say you believe. It's not just about believing the right things. It's about having the courage to live out what you say you believe. And we saw it over and over again. You could look at Esther, look at Daniel, you could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, like all throughout the scriptures, you know, Mary, Paul, and Jesus, like it's this courage in the midst of overwhelming obstacles. And when the odds are against you, that's when faith is needed most. And that really is what helped us tap into this. And then as we kind of dove into that, we were tapping into the civil rights movement and the example of Gandhi. And really, the civil rights movement is one of the best expressions of Christian faith that we could find in the United States context. And a lot of times it's left to history. It's something we look back to and say, oh, wasn't that nice? Or, you know, wasn't that great that they did that back then? Rather than saying, this was a faith-fueled movement that is an example that we can live into every day in the situations that we're facing right now. And so, yeah, I think we've really discovered this idea. This is not us coming up with anything. It's really about us discovering and also developing in ourselves and people that we are discipling this faith that is movement, this faith that creates love and justice in the world.
Well, it's interesting too, Sean, that, you know, Tutu and others too talk about the whole, what's the Swahili word, Ubuntu or Ubuntu, or yes, that our lives are interconnected, that when something happens to another, yeah, it affects me. And it seems to me that a lot of what your book is, you know, and I think you talk about that in the book a little bit too. I'm reading about three at the same time, so sometimes I don't know. But that interconnectedness, it certainly ties back into the scriptures when we talk about the body of Christ, and we are there for each other, and, you know, every person in this world carries the image of God, right?
I want to turn back to Rashida, too. Thank you for making that point, Mike. The interconnectedness is... that cannot be lost on us. And one of the things that I appreciate that you talk about in the book is the several of these pivot points. You know, we're not far from continuing on this journey, but we just have to make some pivots. And one of the big ones, Rashida, that you talk about is moving from fear to freedom. And I'm telling you, there's a boatload of fear today. I'm personally struggling a little bit with it in our current climate in America, and I know others are as well. To me, this might even be the most important pivot point. I don't know what you think, but talk about how we can move from fear to freedom when we're not sure we can.
Yeah, that's good, Anita. And that's exactly why we start the book there, because Sean and I are pretty firm in our belief that in order to do the other pivots well, the first thing we have to do as individuals and as a collective is to move from fear to freedom. There are so many sources feeding our fear factors today.
Yeah.
Our media is constantly feeding us reasons to be afraid. Our government, to be honest, is constantly feeding us reasons to be afraid. Some of which I think are quite legitimate reasons to be afraid. And also in the season that we're in, our institutions, many of our institutions were constructed and imagined a very long time ago in a very different context than the one we live in today. And as a result, some of them have struggled to hold their relevance, and that the transition of boomers, baby boomers, out of leadership roles and sort of passing the torch has created some fear and concern, as all of our institutions are doing that work simultaneously. So there are tons of spaces and places where we can feed our fears. I think that there are fewer and fewer spaces that are calling for a resurgence of courage and freedom. And I think we have to do the work of looking for those spaces and those places that really inspire us to be courageous in our thinking and our being, and to fight for freedom, not just on behalf of ourselves, but on behalf of whomever is on the margin of who we are. And I say it that way because I define margin very differently than I believe the church and the world sometimes homogeneously defines margin as only those who are poor, or only those who live in urban centers, or only those who live in what the church has defined as third world space. But really, your margin is anyone who is least like you, and everyone who makes you uncomfortable because it's not normative to be around this environment or space or people. And again, the media and the world has done a really good job of helping us and inspiring fear in us about those who represent our margin. And so for me, my margin doesn't look like the margin that the church universally singularly in narrative espouses, only the poor, only people of color, only urban center. That actually would be my center, right? Those are people I would feel very comfortable being around, people who look like me and sound like me. But if I am to go to the margin, my role is to look for people who are least like me. And so white conservative evangelicals, for example, particularly male ones, would be my margin. That would be very far from my center, those that I'm comfortable with or accustomed to. And so, and I have lots of reasons to be afraid of people who look and sound like white conservative evangelical males, because they haven't historically, traditionally had my best interest in heart, at heart. But I believe that a book like Soul Force causes us to reach deep beyond the surface of what we think we have the capacity to do and really activate our faith. We talk a lot about our faith, especially in evangelical circles, but we don't activate it. We don't trust its capacity to hold and carry us into spaces with people and places that aren't like us. And so for me, for example, I spend a great deal of my time in ministry working with white conservative evangelical males because that's my margin. And I believe that when we can operate in marginalized spaces and towards the goal and objective of mutuality and reciprocity, then we're moving towards that beloved community that King talked about. And to be clear, and we talk about this in chapter one, moving from fear to freedom does not mean waiting until my fear dissipates, that I'm no longer afraid and now I can move in my freedom. That faith is the evidence of things not seen. And so I might still be afraid and probably will be, but I'm not walking in my faith until I'm doing something that's bigger and greater than I am. And that might be fearful or cause fear in me. So we have a section in the book that talks about doing it anyway. Afraid, I believe, is what the text says. And really encouraging people within their community and beyond to say, yes, I'm afraid of this, or yes, I'm afraid of being in this context, or I'm skittish about being around this particular group of people. And though I am afraid, I am going to move forward and do it anyway. I think it's important also to name that this is actually a Christian faith orientation. When Christ discovered what his biggest work, his magnum opus, was going to be. He said, you know, take this cup from me. It wasn't something that he was necessarily fearlessly and courageously staring down. But in the end, he said, yet not my will, but your will, Lord. And so he did it afraid. And so Christ has set the tone and has been the primary model for this idea of moving from fear to freedom, because it wasn't in spite of his fear that we all have salvation today. And so I think that if we are to call ourselves Christians, and particularly to use this language of being the hands and feet of Christ, then we have to exhibit a willingness to go beyond our fear, much like Christ did.
First of all, I love your definition of margin. Love that phrase, activate our faith, that we talk about our faith, but we don't activate it. I just wanted to get that in there. And then, Mike, I think you have a follow-up.
Well, I love that, too. And I know many white conservative evangelical male that would be aghast that they were the margins for someone else. But I think that was just a wonderful way of putting that. But I'm reminded, you know, and when you say do it afraid, that's one of the hardest things for people to do. I'm fond of a quote by Amelia Earhart, who once said, courage is the price that life exacts for granting peace. And in order to move from freedom to fear, and you talk about that throughout the book, there is a modicum of courage to take that first step. But it's in the journey that all of a sudden you begin to discover that some of your fears just begin to evaporate just a little bit, you know, and you begin to see that maybe you could be wrong, even if you can't admit it. And then you just move forward. But as a pastor of a church, Sean, you were at one of the churches that I served. It was filled with white evangelical men and women. And for them to move from fear to freedom, it was a necessary journey that they had to take. But it's difficult. And Sean, I'm just wondering, as you go, just as Rashida does, do you run into opposition to these ideas when you move towards your margins, and Rashida, as you move towards yours? And what do you do with that opposition?
Yeah, I think, fear is universal. And when we talk about, if we can get folks to name fears and talk about fears, we find that we actually have a lot in common, and fear kind of immobilizes all of us, really. Yes. There are places personally that we all are get stuck in fear, and it keeps us from doing the things that we want to do, the things that we may feel called to do. And so when we talk about that, everybody kind of enters into that conversation. And it's actually, I think, one of the most transformational things is to name your fear, because it takes some of the power away from it. And it gives you insight. And so, you know, in chapter one, we actually list out, you know, personal fears, leadership fears, societal fears. And I think everybody can find something on that list that is actually holding them up right now. And that's one of the things about fear. It's like, it's not just like, I overcame my fear and now, you know, I'm all good. It's like fear keeps showing up in different places. And once you get it in one area, it'll show up in another area. But I think there is opposition. There's always opposition to freedom. There's always opposition to movement and to community. And so the opposition, shows up as fear. It shows up as ignorance. It shows up as indifference. It shows up as division. And so, you know, that leads us into the next pivot is from barriers to bridge building. And we have to kind of acknowledge that there are some real significant barriers that are in our world. And so we also name those as internal barriers and external barriers. And a lot of times in our world, especially as we're divided very, very, very sharply around conservative liberal or around Republican, Democrat, or, you know, there's so many.
You're not talking about our country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard other countries struggle with these things. But one of the interesting things is you, when you look at those ideologies, you know, the conservative ideology is more focused around the personal and the internal. Right. And, you know, we need to deal with our anger, and we need to deal with our selfishness. And that's these internal barriers. And then the liberal side is more concerned about the external, and the external barriers, like we need to deal with this, the systems and the structures and poverty and injustice, right? And what we do when we divide those is then we just divided up a holistic movement. We've created a personal stream, and we've created a systemic stream, and that keeps movement from happening. So what SoulForce does is it breaks down the barrier between those two and says, you know what, there's a deep connection between the personal and the social, between the internal and the external. And it's just as important that we remove the internal barriers of fear and anger and hatred and selfishness as it is the external barriers of poverty and violence and marginalization. And actually, they are one and the same work, and they're interconnected. And that I think is one of the most powerful things, is when we realize the holistic nature of love and of the movement of God, then we unleash this movement into the world. So yes, I think there's opposition on all sides, and I think we all are part of constructing the barriers and enforcing them, as well as, you know, sometimes we like to think, well, the opposition is out there, but we are also part of building up the walls within our own selves and in society.
Well, and Sean, let me maybe continue on. I think it might serve us well to even hear a story of someone. One of the things I appreciate that you talk about are your own stories, yours and Rashida's sharing her own story in here as well. And you include some other people's stories on how they have specifically leaned into these pivot points that you're talking about. I think it might be interesting to hear something that's illustrative of this particular one, you know, Bridget, barriers to bridges, because I think that's a huge one right now in our world.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples of this. One of the ones that sticks out to me is actually taking some of our young people, our mission year young adults, into the prison, and talk about physical barriers, right? There's prison walls, right?
Yeah.
And prison bars. And we took one of the young ladies, you know, she was from Texas. She was Republican. She was very conservative. She had a clear idea about who was in there and why they were there. You know, they deserved to be in there, and they were society, the worst of society, right? And we went in there, and we were able to go up to the actual cell of folks that were in there. And I took her intentionally to Eddie's cell. And Eddie is one of the strongest Christians I know. And he, the whole time, she thought maybe she could help and give some hope to folks that are in prison. The whole time, Eddie witnessed to her and shared his faith with her, and, you know, talked about where he was struggling with really authentically. And at the end, we put our hands through the bars and we were praying. And I looked over at the young lady, and she was just crying. Tears were just streaming down her face. And so when we got outside, I asked her, I said, what was happening? What was going on? And she said, you know, I always thought about people in prison as just, you know, these other people here, but I realized in that moment, this was my brother. Mm-hmm. And she had not thought about that there are people in prison that are our brothers and sisters in Christ. And it required something extra of her, that sure, she can't just dismiss them. She saw their humanity. She saw, I'm connected. And now I can't just leave it. I have to do something about this. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And a friend of ours.
It's like another, Sean, I don't want to interrupt, but she had another conversion moment. That was another conversion in her life. it's, you know, by just coming to that aha moment and going, oh my God, it's bigger than I thought he was. And those are the kind of things that you just go, you just want to jump up and down and dance, even though I'm a horrible dancer.
Yes, it's when we see the humanity in the people that we have marginalized, the people we think are enemies, the people we think are so different from us, that is when our hearts are changed. And I think that's what Soul Force does. That Dr. King modeled that, right? Of while he's fighting for freedom, while he's resisting, he's also saying, we will not return hate with hate. We will love those, even those that are creating problems for us, even those that are bombing our churches and our homes, we're going to respond with love back. That is divine. That is what God does to us. God does not return evil for evil. God does not return hatred with hatred, but with love. And even when Scripture says, even when we're faithless, God is faithful. And God shows us that kind of love. That's the love we are called to embody.
And it's a lot more radical than we think. That's what I love hearing these stories and hearing the two of you talk about these important pivot points. Rashida, what's another pivot point we can't miss in our relatively short conversation? Point us to another one and describe how we can engage with this, with another pivot point.
Well, I feel compelled to call us to pivot four, not because it's my favorite, but actually Sean will tell you it is my least favorite pivot.
Okay.
The pivot from hurt to hope, I think, goes quite well with pivot one in this season and context of our country, that we have to make this pivot from fear to freedom. And in so doing, I think there is an inherent process that involves pain and suffering. And I think that part of the reason why we don't make the pivot, the first pivot, well, is because there is some inherent pain and suffering, some discomfort and some relinquishing of our own power and some acknowledgement of our own weakness and our own vulnerability. And our reliance and dependence upon one another. And all of that will cause us to find ourselves in some hard and difficult places, not impossible places, not insurmountable places. But I think that the culture of our national context drives us towards all things comfortable. I'm actually in Orlando right now, and my daughter, who loves Disney, I am taking one for the team for sure, and being here. You might imagine that a justice fighter like me is really struggling in Disney World. But just how much I've been reflecting in the last 24 hours on how far we're willing to go and to such great lengths that we are willing to go in order to create comfort for ourselves. It is amazing how responsive this theme park is to Americans, even to the point of being exploitative and culturally co-optive to make this country comfortable. And I believe that Disney World is a microcosm of a much larger issue. And it is our absolute unwillingness to be uncomfortable and to relinquish power, wealth, resources towards a better way of being, not just for some of us, but for all of us. And so I talk a little bit about our desire. This is actually in chapter 3 in Self-Centeredness and Solidarity. I talk about Hamilton, the production, and how when I went to see the performance, people came out in droves for this performance. And of course, I'm standing in the foyer thinking to myself, do you all know that this is wrought with hip hop culture and all the marginalized culture and people groups of our world. And it didn't stop people from buying tickets to the tune of $300-$500 a person to participate. Similarly, Disney World is supposed to be a place that is indicative of all cultures and heritages. I don't know that it is, but it is at least indicative of that. And you have to wait 90 minutes to ride a ride because the lines are so long. And so what that says to me, Anita, is that we have a deep desire for solidarity, for community, for intersectionality. There's something inside of us really wants that and knows that that is the prize over capitalism. It's the prize above and beyond consumerism. But the thing that's keeping us from having that solidarity that we talk about in chapter three is our unwillingness to face the hurt and the suffering that we have already caused, and to lament that authentically and to name our complicitness in it from a vulnerable place. And also our unwillingness, our lack of willingness and desire to be uncomfortable enough to learn from one another. Mm-hmm. There's a smaller piece that I wrote on the Live website, a blog post called A PhD in Suffering. Mm. And in that piece, I talk about how, given our current season, politically, religiously, culturally, environmentally, we are all suffering. It is the one thing that we certainly all have in common today. We might articulate that suffering differently, but we're certainly all experiencing it. The distinction I make is that some of us have been suffering for a really long time. And because we have, we know how to do it quite well. We know how to do it and still hold our lives together. We know how to do it and still manage our families and our vocations and our faith and all of that. And then some of us, now that we have entered into the political area, arena that we're in, we are struggling and suffering, and we haven't had a lot of practice or experience in it. And the only way to move from the space of suffering that we're in to a more agile place of belonging is to lock arms with people who know suffering firsthand. And this is why the civil rights movement is such an important teaching tool for the era that we're now witnessing and experiencing, that it is through the people who know suffering firsthand that other people might learn mm-hmm. how to be in community and how to be transformed by the discomfort of it. And just a quick caveat on hurt to hope. I want to name that this is not a place out of which we affirm ourselves as martyrs. And this is not a theology of being downtrodden and heavy labored and heavy laden for the sake of it. This is not that. This is the necessity of discomfort towards the freedom and liberation of all people. And so I want to make that distinction because I think there's the risk of an unhealthy theology that can emerge there. Okay. But in the book, we're clear about this as a purposed suffering towards the freedom and liberation of everyone. Mm-hmm. And learning how to live that out comes from being coming alongside people and being with them, those who have a narrative of suffering, but who have emerged and now have a resilience and a sustainability and a viability towards movement making that we can all glean and learn from.
Two things. One, I'm so glad you mentioned your blog. I just want people to know that they can find all of these links to both of your organizations and you know, Twitter handles, Facebook, all whatever, in the show notes of this podcast. Regular listeners to the podcast know that, but I just wanted to say that. Or if you're online, you can go to anitalustria.com and you can find it all right there on the homepage. Sean, let me go from what Rashida said to turn it to you to see if you want to add anything. I guess I kind of wanted to ask this question in the midst of moving from hurt to hope. You know, some are less, have been in that space maybe for less time or have experienced less trauma or suffering, and so they struggle to stay in it. They sometimes, and I'll say, you know, sometimes I feel like I want to bury my head in the sand. I don't really, but sometimes you need breaks and that to go back at it. But I don't want people to take a break and not go back at it. But talk about just that whole idea of trauma and suffering, and how do we make that pivot toward hope if we've not had as much experience, maybe?
Yeah, that's great. And I was hoping that this would come up because I wanted to make sure it's clear from, so I'm coming from the dominant culture, right? I'm coming from a place of more privilege in society as a white male who's middle class. And for me, I've had to learn soul force from those who are directly impacted by injustice. For me, I have networks of resources that doesn't require me to live out of this place of soul force as a necessity. It's more of a choice for me. But as I've entered into solidarity with people who are directly impacted by injustice, whether that's in under-resourced communities, whether that's in the prison, whether that's leaders of color who are running nonprofits on shoestring budgets because they do not have the same social networks. I'm learning that soul force is a necessity, and people have to depend on this extra strength. And when they're facing all of this adversity, they're seeing this rise up within them. So for me, I have to get closer to those that are directly impacted. I have to be in that struggle with them, not only so what the narrative is usually, so I can help them, right? But really, I need to be there too for my own sake, because, you know, we saw when the election happened, lots of white people were like, oh my gosh, you know, or as we're hearing about all of the kind of resurgence, we're seeing the resurgence of racism and in Charlottesville, we're like, oh my gosh, there's racism in the country, you know? And people of color are like, yeah, we've been dealing with this for 400 years, right? But this is, for us, a lot of us, this is a new thing to struggle in the depths of our soul with the state of the world, that we're seeing the injustice in new ways. And so we're like, we don't have the resources. We haven't been taught how to develop sustainability, resilience, hope. That's why we have to learn it. That's why we have to be in a relationship with people. My relationship with Rashida has taught me so much about resilience and soul force. Neighbors in my community on the west side of Chicago have taught me what hope really looks like and what faith really looks like. So it's really, I think for us, we have to commit to the process of learning and aligning ourselves with others who live this out. I mean, when I talk about going to the prison with guys who are in for life, how do you have hope if you know you're going to be in prison for the rest of your life, but yet they sustain hope every day? They are the ones we should be learning from and sitting at the feet of. So that's what I would kind of say to that. I think the more that we enter into solidarity, the more that we enter into places of injustice, the more soul force is needed, and the more we'll see it rise up within us. We have the resilience in us too. We just haven't had that.
Haven't had to tap into it. Yeah. Haven't had to tap into it. Yeah. Okay. This is packed with goodness, this podcast. Mike, anything? I mean, there's a boatload of things that we have not asked or had the time to ask. Anything that you want to ask that we've not touched on yet before I wrap up?
I only have about 15 questions.
I know, me too.
I think we have time. But I just want to say I'm so thankful that you folks wrote this book. Mm-hmm. And I hope anybody that's listening to that, this, will go out and get it, but then find some people that they can talk it over with and make it even an intentional journey on their part to find some, decide to find people that aren't, that don't look like them and think like them all the time. And
well, and to let me add into that, that in the back of the book, there are discussion and reflection questions, which I think make it a perfect small group study, or, you know, two people, three people get together and read and discuss, because I think this is essential. I mean, this is really it's at the center and the heartbeat of the book too, that this is a community endeavor here.
Right.
Yeah. Mike, I
think sometimes what happens, we try to talk about issues like are raised in the book, and we always do it with like-minded people, and we end up at the same place. In fact, we reinforce some of the negative things that really God doesn't want for us.
Yeah.
And I think it is true that we come into this world where we need to iron sharpening iron. Well, that's by sitting down with folks that may disagree with you, that have a whole different life experience. And it's uncomfortable at the start sometimes, but all of a sudden you realize, what am I really afraid of?
Yeah, right.
And what I'm really afraid of is myself and the stuff that I have in me, and we find that we really do love and care about people.
That's a really good question to ask yourself, or for all of us to be asking ourselves, because what I have discovered is that in every place where I have lacked mobility or inertia around something I feel a deep calling or desire to do, it has been rooted in fear 100% of the time. But what's been interesting about that question of what am I, not just to settle in on because I'm afraid, but to ask myself, well, what are you afraid of? And really start to list out what I'm afraid of. What often happens is I realize that most of what I would name as what I'm afraid of is contrived. Mm. It's not even real.
Yeah.
And so these notions that aren't even really credible notions are keeping me from carrying out the life that I was intended to carry out. And they're not even true. When I launched the cafe, one of the things I was afraid of is that I would lose everything and my children and I would end up, you know, homeless. Well, the Castleberries are never going to let my children, at least not my children, they might let me stay. They're gonna get the kids. They'll get the girls for sure. And so, but I have a community around me that loves and supports me and my family.
Yeah.
So this notion of being afraid that everything will fall apart and I'll have, that's not real. Mm. So this idea of going deeper and saying, no, not just, oh, because I'm afraid, but why am I afraid? Is what I'm afraid of really something to be afraid of? Or is it something that could easily be mitigated? I think we've not been trained or have a practice in delving deep into our fears in that way.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really powerful thing to do. And I think that the church has some responsibility in equipping people to be able to do that.
I agree with you.
Any last word, Sean? I'll turn it to you. That was fantastic, Rashida. Appreciate that.
I just want to say, if anybody's listening to this and is feeling feeling like God is calling them to do something, or feeling like they want to go after something but they've been held back, we just want to say you can do this. Like, you're stronger than you think. You have this deep capacity within you. God will meet you in the place where you are, and Soul Force is really it's the Spirit of God and our human brilliance and resilience where that meets. And so I just want anyone listening, like, don't let your fears hold you back. Do it anyway. Do it afraid. Gather community around you. Step across those boundary lines. Because as I've been thinking about it, you know, 15 years ago, my wife and I moved into the west side of Chicago. We had so many fears, but I can now trace every good thing in my life right now can trace back to that decision. And so if I would have let fear hold me back in that moment, I would have missed out on so much. And so we just don't want anyone missing out on the full experience of what they were created for. We want to see people come alive. So that's my final thing. Pursue that which makes you come alive.
Yes.
Well, and great place to wrap up. This was fantastic and powerful. Like I say that like I didn't expect it. I don't know what I expected, but this was fabulous. Big thanks to Rashida Graham Washington and Sean Castleberry. More information in the show notes and at anitalustria.com. The name of the book, Soul Force, Seven Pivots Toward Courage, Community, and Change. Take up the challenge that's been laid down for us in deep love and kindness by Rashida and Sean here today. Mike, thank you to you as well. To everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.